It's the network break. Brew a coffee and spin up a virtual donut and join us for this Packet Pushers podcast on the latest news from the tech industry with analysis, opinion, insight, and the occasional rant. I'm your host, Drew Connery Murray, and with me, is, as always, is the impeccable Greg Farrow. Greg, how are you?
Impeccable to this week. That's great.
Yes.
That's much better than ineffable or inimitable.
You've been keeping track. I'm going to see how far I can take this. Also joining us this week is our guest, Russ White. Russ is a network architect and author. Russ, thank you for being with us.
Thanks. And you know, virtual donut, I had a real one this morning.
Oh, that's even better. Yeah, those kick virtual donuts butts. So before we dive into the news, I want to thank our sponsor, Riverbed. Your work, your business, your productivity, they all depend on the performance of your applications. So let Riverbed, the application performance company, accelerate your software-driven enterprise. And also thanks to Aruba Atmosphere. That's the leading mobility conference, which is taking place in Las Vegas, March 6th through the 11th this year. And Greg and Ether are going to be there, and we'll tell you a little bit more about it later in the show. Diving into the news, this story jumped out at me this week. Spotify presses play on Google Cloud. This is continuing the public cloud discussion that we've been having for the past couple of episodes. And so this week we learned Spotify is in the process of moving all of its back-end infrastructure to the Google Cloud platform. And according to the Spotify blog, the company's been buying and leasing its own data center space, but they concluded that, you know, storage, compute, and network services in the cloud are now comparable.
Well, that's gilding the lily a little, I think. It was only 3 weeks ago that Spotify announced it made a $47 million loss. Somebody dug up some documents from a couple of years back, and it was making a massive loss. Mm-hmm. And the question is it going to be in business for much longer if it keeps burning cash that fast?
I don't know what size data centers they have, but I'm not convinced that buying Google Cloud is actually cheaper than building your own at a certain scale. I'm sure smaller it might be. If when you get to a certain scale, you can't afford Google Cloud compared to building your own stuff. It's just insane.
To me, this is an example of a poor company, a company that's on the borderline of existence. It's burning cash. It's a startup. They still don't have a revenue model that matches the opportunity. Yeah. You know, everybody's saying how Spotify pays artists so little, and Spotify turns around and says, we're not making any money. You know, we're struggling to survive. We can't afford to keep paying the publishers, the music publishers, the rates we're paying. The artists might get almost nothing, but the music publishers get most of it. And the music publishers are unhappy, but Spotify can't charge any more than $10 a month for a streaming service. So to me, this is a sign that Spotify is under serious financial pressure, and the cloud allows them to hang on for another 6 to 12 months while they cross their fingers and hope to survive.
Well, and not only that, but the cloud allows them to adjust their cost based on their actual usage, whereas if they actually built their own data center, they wouldn't be able to do that, right?
Yes.
So building your own data center assumes that you have a pretty constant revenue stream that you can count on. They don't apparently have that to do that right now. Yeah. And you know, I don't really see this as a huge win for quote-unquote public cloud, because they were already using AWS. And yeah, they played with the data center, building their own data center stuff, but it's not like they were full-on, you know, some other large media company going out and saying, all right, we're dumping the 5 data centers that we own or the 20 data centers that we own, and we're going to Google Cloud. Mm-hmm. It's not exactly that. This seems like it's a big win for Google Cloud, but I just don't actually see it as much as maybe others do.
Not everybody who's on Google Cloud is talking about it. So I posted a blog post this week about, and I think we talked about this last week, Drew, that people who go into the public cloud talk long and loud about their public cloud because it's good business. They can recruit people. They can, and as when your startup crashes, you can go walk off to the next job based pointing your finger at things that you've talked about, and there's very good incentives if you work on the public cloud to talk about on the public cloud so that you can lower your costs in terms of recruitment. And keep in mind that even if you're spending 3 times as much in OPEX, that's still cheaper when you don't have any CAPEX. And as you say, no guaranteed revenue, not a very profitable business model, or you're crossing your fingers hoping for it to survive. And that pretty much sums up the state of streaming music. Pandora's gone broke. RDO's in deep trouble. Spotify's a survivor, but Apple Music came along and took all the fun out of it. Kanye was on Twitter the other week begging for people to go and use Tidal because he's in debt to the tune of $50 million. This isn't a sign of a great move for the Google Cloud. This is a sign that Spotify's business model is in trouble. Getting onto the cloud allows them to cross their fingers and hope that things will pick up in the next year or two before they burn up all their cash.
Yep. Well, I was actually thinking that it was kind of a coup for Google because it's a brand name, you know, a hip name that's actually moving into their cloud when Google as a cloud provider has been sort of playing second fiddle to Amazon and Azure. So I was taking a sort of different approach, but it sounds like you guys think Spotify might not be around that long anyway.
Well, the second question, of course, is will Google Cloud be around for that long?
You know? Yeah, I mean, they don't seem to get good reviews, do they?
Well, they don't. I mean, they consistently discontinue products after just a year or two's effort and say, oh, you know what?
Yeah.
Blah, shut it down. You know, Facebook did it with PaaS. Now, let's be clear here. AWS has shut down plenty of business units before, but we don't tend to hear about that for some reason because as a general rule, they are much better at picking ones that survive. And the services that they build are often don't require a lot of effort or a lot of sustenance. So I suspect that we'll see AWS shut down more services in the future. They've opened up an awful lot. They are announcing services at a rate of about one a week. Some of them have to shut down eventually because they are going to fail or products die and pass away. Mm-hmm. And it can't be profitable to keep sustaining an infinite number of software projects inside a company like Amazon, who is absolutely brutal on cost. So if that product's not profitable, they are going to kill them. Haven't seen a lot because Amazon's been very smart. The AWS team's been very smart about what they invest in. Google Cloud, you've got to question whether Google is serious about it, because the story is that Google's cloud isn't the cloud that they use. Google's apps run in another part of the data center, and Google Cloud's over here. It's the same physical infrastructure, but the software platforms aren't necessarily the same. That's not a problem, really, because, of course, AWS, Amazon runs on a completely different infrastructure from AWS, as I understand it, so that's not a big deal. But yeah. AWS is kind of all in on the public cloud where – and this is where Alphabet needs to come in. It needs to pick up Google Cloud and say it's not part of Google anymore. It's Alphabet Cloud or right. some other yeah, name yeah, yeah. so that it's yeah. dedicated and focused and that's its profit margin. Whereas while it's sort of part of Google, it carries all the baggage that's Google's got. Google makes hundreds of tens of billions of dollars out of advertising. Everything's just an insignificant overhead compared to that business. And everything's at risk. I mean, Reader, Wave, you know, the list is endless. Those, yeah. Not that those products weren't profitable or that they weren't useful to Google. They've got to be making tens of billions of dollars for Google to put focus into them.
And that's well, and not only that, I think they have to be interesting for Google internally. Right? Google Docs is interesting to Google internally, but is Google Cloud interesting to Google internally? Probably not. Hmm. So, you know, there's no internal use case to drive new features and stuff. And so it's very difficult to see how they justify it.
This is one difference, though, between public cloud and private cloud company, and enterprise IT companies, of course, right? Is that enterprise IT companies do keep dragging along their coffin technologies or their museum technologies, as I call them, those 30-year-long projects like HP with HP UX and Cisco with its 3800 series routers that could be just replaced with an x86 and a Surface, they continue to bring those products to market because they're still profitable, but they're really only a couple of billion dollars a year in revenue in those business units, whereas Google or Amazon would say a couple of billion dollars, get rid of it. Time to move on to the next thing, because even the time spent extracting that couple of billion dollars worth of profit means we've missed out on tens of billions of dollars worth of profit somewhere else.
Google has kind of a dilettante problem. They've got so much money coming in from advertising. If they can mess around for a while in one area and then say, we're done. It was fun for
a while. It's also, but it's also dismissive of the customers, which I think is what you see in the experience that the average user might have of Google Cloud. On the user interface side of it, I mean, or on the technical support side of it, you see bigger companies come in and say, you know, we get great support from these guys. Yeah, but you're spending however much money a year, and you're not the average person. So the average person goes to Google Cloud, and sure, the Google guys, you know, say, well, we're trolling this, and we're trolling that list, and we're trying to keep up with this. There's only so many of those guys out there that can do that. And what does that actually do to the customer support, and how much does that leave you on your own?
How much is that hard to consume? Right. It's not easy. You don't just walk up there and start doing the same things as you've always done. Put an ISO of a Linux box and suck it in here and boot it up. You've got to learn how to adapt. I tried to use the Google Cloud, and you know, quite honestly, it was not easy. There was very little documentation. It was obsolete or just flat out incorrect. And there was no support because it's the second tier cloud. There was no hack and use, no Stack Overflow, no whatever. It was quite difficult to get over that hump.
Moving from cloud back to the premises, and here's a rumor from the market, a rumor. CRN is saying that according to their sources, who they didn't name, Cisco may be unveiling a hyper-converged offering. And they're also going to try to undercut the startups via pricing.
Sorry. What, undercut the pricing of startups, Cisco? That was the hardest part of this article. The story is, of course, is that Cisco's partner conference is next week, and that's where Cisco gets together all its partners, and a big believer in partners, and it gives all of its super secret information to Cisco's resellers, so they have a competitive advantage over customers. because they have information that customers can't have, which sort of points out how much these companies love their customers because they don't give them all the information that they need to make their own decisions. The second part is that Cisco is coming into the hyperconverged market. Now, remember that Nutanix and Plivity and those types of people have been doing very good business and taking away money from VCE. We know that VCE proved the model of converged works and converged at the upper end of the enterprise scale. They have a $2 billion run rate, which means somebody out there is buying $750 million a quarter of V-blocks, for goodness sakes. At that price margin, you don't have to sell too many to make that sort of number. But in the mid-market, Nutanix and Simplivity have been going great guns. So Cisco wants to get into that market because it's a place where UCS servers could offer something to people. And when you buy UCS servers as part of the stacked-up offerings, you know, they've had the deal with NetApp and the converged play that they've done there. They've just made quite good money and locked customers into their platforms hand over fist. The guess is that they're going to bring one out next week when the partners get together with at the mid-market instead of the high end of the market. That's how I read it anyway.
I think it's kind of humorous that the hyperconvergence, whole hyperconvergence thing, I'm going to see as like mainframe mini to some degree. And so it's kind of funny to me that we've come full circle and now Cisco is becoming IBM in reality. So anyway.
I agree.
The other thing that's interesting is that you said about the partner summit and the partners is I really feel for the Cisco partners right now. A lot of them have been so focused on Cisco that they've not learned any other technologies. And it's just been one of those things where nobody gets fired for buying Cisco. It's not going to last. And these partners need to get up and go do something with themselves for better or for worse. They need to get out there and learn something and do something other than Cisco. But I don't know how much they see that coming.
I mean, the article says that Cisco's going to play on price, and I just find that Cisco's not going to do that. Cisco's going to say they've got the best possible hyperconverged solution, and it's going to be twice the price of Nutanix. But, you know, Nutanix has to prove that they're not a startup anymore, that they're a player like Dell and EMC. And Dell's going to be – has got – they've got three or four teams inside the company producing converged offerings, even from right the way from extreme scale. So they now have a team that produces, it's called the Extreme Scale Initiative, where they produced hyper-converged offerings for high-performance compute people. That is, if you want to buy 1,000 servers for HPC infrastructure or 2,000, they'll custom build you the whole thing from the ground up and validate it for you. They've got people in the middle building hyper-converged systems for Azure Private Cloud. So you can go and buy a Microsoft Azure Private Cloud to run on-prem, and you can buy a specific set of Dell, which is approved, and they'll guarantee you the performance at this many VMs with this amount of storage and this much compute, blah, 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 blah. In the sense that Cisco's coming to hyperconverged late in the game, even though the success of the partnership with NetApp, it's the lack of storage. So Cisco's failure to get that storage startup integrated and get that storage to scale means they're going to be a little bit slow to come to market. But what they've done is done a deal with one of the smaller hyperconverged players to put their software on Cisco hardware and take it to market for the mid-sized. It's not going to be at the big end. It's at the mid-sized to small market.
Two other interesting things is that Cisco bought rather than built. I mean, I know this is their habit.
They didn't buy it. They're partnering with a very small.
Right. But nonetheless, even if they partnered rather than built, I guess that's Cisco's modus operandi, but it's kind of strange. And the other thing is, I wonder how much this is a reaction belated to some degree of the whole VCE thing.
Oh, well,
I mean, I don't know. It's just one of those things that occurs to me that.
Well, they know how successful that's been because FlexPod's been a huge win for Cisco. At the same time that VCE, which is the EMC Cisco tie up, as much as Cisco, but then they've also looked at what Dell's been doing, where they'll sell their hardware to anybody who wants to build on top. So Nutanix, for example, used to make their own hardware. Now they're all in with Dell.
Right, but so, VCE kind of untethered itself from Cisco, right, last year, didn't they?
Sort of, yes. So Cisco's no longer invested in the joint partnership anymore, and EMC now offers V-blocks that have Lenovo's or Quanta servers in the V-blocks, and theoretically customers should be buying the V-block, not Cisco UCS servers. I bet there's a lot of UCS servers being still sold into V-blocks because that's what customers want.
Right, but the whole EMC Dell thing is probably a shot across the bow of a lot of that. So there's just another entire maybe underlying thing going on there that's not obvious on the surface. But
well, you know, the FlexPod from NetApp and Cisco is a you know, it's been fairly successful. And the ultimately, the value of the hyperconverged and enterprise IT is that the CIO doesn't have to have the networking guy, the storage guy, the virtualization person, the server person, all of those people around the table and agree that, you know, I'm going to buy Cisco switches, I'm going to buy HP servers, right. and I'm going to buy NetApp storage or, you know, EMC storage. And then they have to all work together. It's much easier to just go and say, I'll buy a FlexPod. So you don't have to sit through 5 days of meetings and watch those fools argue with each other.
Right, right, yep.
And that's why I did it. I had a chance once and I bought V-blocks just so I didn't have to argue with the storage people because they were being stupid.
Oh boy. That could be an interesting sales tactic. Don't want to talk to storage people? Buy our product.
Yeah, it worked. Saved me months.
All right, we'll get back to the news in a second, but I want to thank one of today's sponsors, Riverbed. Riverbed works to ensure applications perform at their peak for more than 26,000 companies. It's got a platform for providing end-to-end visibility, optimization, and control across the entire enterprise. And that means you get visibility to see everything that impacts the performance of your apps, whether it's the code, the network, the user experience. And that means you can detect and fix issues instantly. Riverbed also accelerates delivery of any app regardless of distance and steers applications over the best network for maximum performance and the lowest TCO. And be sure to catch our latest weekly show podcast with Riverbed. Greg and Ethan sat down to talk about Riverbed and the company's role in open source. You may not have known, but Riverbed is the corporate sponsor of Wireshark, which is a popular packet analyzer. And they talk about Riverbed's involvement, so please take a listen. Okay, getting back to the news. This is a story that jumped out at me. The headline is Bosses Harness Big Data to Predict Which Workers Might Get Sick. It's coming from Dow Jones Business News. And it's telling a story about companies such as Walmart that are hiring firms to gather up and analyze employees. And this struck me as really creepy. Since they'll look through the data to see who might be at risk for diabetes, and then they've got a provider or a partner who sort of nudges them with personalized messages, maybe saying, hey, go see a doctor or get in a weight loss program.
So this is going to sound really strange, but this is actually the area I'm doing my PhD in philosophy in, is this type of stuff. And it's I find this just like... just get away.
there's lots of things in here. Like they talked about being able to identify an employee who might be considering back surgery. And so then this system will send the messages like, hey, maybe try physical therapy or get a second opinion. I mean, the goal is to drive down costs, but driving down costs can also turn into deny people services.
Well, there's another side to this that's kind of strange or hard to me. Is I know I think it was either Ethan or Greg last week or week before something posted a blog post about on packet pushers, I think it was, about how that mobile device that gives you so much convenience actually just means you're taking work everywhere.
That was me.
Well, okay, that was you. This is yet another symptom of that to me. This is just – I no longer have a family life. I no longer have a life outside of work. And I don't know how to – that's like – I don't know how to deal with that.
So I don't think that the smartphone's any different to what it was 10 years ago or 15 years ago. So before there were smartphones and I used to carry around in a pager, I used to have my head stuck in a textbook trying to learn how to be a networking professional. And it's up to you to be a grown-up adult and decide how you live your life. You have to be very intentional, perhaps, and very considered about whether you'll take the phone out of your pocket just to look at it while you're with other people. I can remember people saying the same things about portable radios in the 70s.
I think it's more about the erosion of work and life, that there is now no barrier between when you are at work and when you are outside of work, because work can go with you everywhere.
If you're passive and you let that happen to you, then you made the decision to let that happen to you. 30 years ago, 50 years ago, there was people who were overcommitted to their jobs and, you know, they had to work a little bit harder. If they wanted to work 70 hours a week, they might have had to drive to the office all the time or bring work home with them on the weekends. So it was easier to pretend you didn't have to work. If you didn't bring work home, you could say you didn't do it. But it was certainly doable. I mean, there's nothing new here. It's just it's convenient to do work on the weekends. So now you need to make a conscious, grown-up decision, be empowered about your life and make a thing to say, yes, I could do work on the weekend, but I do not, and move on.
The issue of choices, I think there's a lot of both overt and covert messages about your dedication to an organization if you aren't constantly, you know, sort of present and working. That makes it harder to make a free choice.
Well, it's not only that, but it's also that they're actually going into this whole medical care thing, which you cannot avoid, right? If you work for the company, you're going to be enrolled in this. It's gone from being, from my perspective, of being a volunteer thing to actually, like you said, Drew, it's becoming more and more of a, this is, you'll just do this because it's part of the company culture or whatever.
I've worked with people who obviously live unhealthy lives, you know, whether drinking too much or drug taking or overweight. And it's one thing for people to be unhealthy for a period in their lives. They're having a tough time. Maybe somebody passed away or they're having family problems or whatever it is. But it's another thing to see somebody who just doesn't take care of themselves, or when the consequences of negative lifestyle choices are taken away. So when you get given an amazing healthcare package in America or in the Australia and the UK, you get free healthcare. You can go and live a life of risky, adventurous sex on the top of buildings or on the tops of bridges, because if you damage yourself, the healthcare system's going to pick you up and put you back together, right? If you choose to live a life of eating at Pizza Hut
while you're
for seven nights a week, the health system's going to keep you alive, and so you don't think about the consequences. That's a thing called moral hazard. If you take away the consequences, you have people take greater risks. So that's why when you hire a rental car, it costs an extraordinary amount of money, because people drive rental cars far worse than their own cars and consequently have more accidents, which requires much more maintenance. They flog the cars, the engines blow up, the tires wear out faster. They have to charge a lot more, which then makes the price of renting cars unfeasibly expensive, right? To some extent, if you work for a big company and they give you an amazing healthcare package, right, and then you abuse your health by living a life of zero exercise or sitting at work and being overcommitted for 70 hours a week and not getting enough mental stimulation, you have mental health problems because you're worrying about work all the time instead of having a good social life, then maybe this is the other side of that debate. Whereas if this system can predict that, it'll kick you into living a better lifestyle.
And right now, the system that's being talked about in this article is voluntary. You can opt in. And that's, to me, a key part of this, that it should be voluntary, that it's opt-in, that the decisions or the nudges that come your way, you can decide to take on or take off or ignore. But my worry is that there are also systems and mechanisms where what is presented as a choice, you know the way things actually work, it's not a choice. You do it or it's going on your record, it's a black mark, and pretty soon there are going to be real consequences, like maybe you losing your job. The second thing is just the degree to which an organization, a business, feels like it can look into my personal life, what I do outside of work.
You know, the freedoms that you have today is predicated on the fact that you earned those in the past. So in the 1920s and the 18th century, you didn't have these freedoms. So don't feel that you're entitled or that they're a right. There was something that was given as the economy was good and you earned them. And these things are changeable and fungible.
Well, that's why I'm talking about it, because I want to make sure people are aware and that we push back against it. We don't just accept it and have it come down on us. I mean, if we have to fight for it, we have to fight for it. But first, we have to be aware of it.
Let's not use the word fight, because you're not going to pick up a weapon and fight for it. Jesus. Right?
Let's advocate for it.
Much better.
Is that better?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm an American. I like to fight. I'm an American.
But remember that part of advocating and or pushing back is to take responsibility, right, for yourself.
Yes.
Because otherwise, like Greg says, if you can't take care of yourself, somebody else is going to take care of you for you. And that's actually it's a problem.
And underneath all of that, there has to be a thing called a social safety net. So for those people who have mental breakdowns, and if this system then says we're going to kick you out of the system because out of the company because you have mental health problems, well, there has to be a social safety net to take care of the people who fall out of the system, right? If you're not in a position to care for yourself, if you have a back problem, a genetic problem, or you break a leg, or you have a mental breakdown, or you have to leave the system for some reason. And that's why you have national health care and private health care combined is the better system. One of the most common causes for middle-class bankruptcy in the USA, I read this article recently and I can't find it, I'm sorry, but is medical problems. People get sick, they have a heart attack or some critical medical event, they run out of money because they can't pay for their health care, and then they actually go bankrupt. And then they can't get back into a job and rebuild their lives.
Right.
If people fall out of the system, you have to achieve some minimum level of care as part of the social good, so that if the system that you're propagating here fails you, there's somewhere where you don't end up, you know, dying in a gutter in poverty type of stuff. And that's what we learned in the 18th century, is that it's equally bad for business.
All right, well, we'll leave that there.
But
This is a very interesting discussion, and perhaps we'll come back to it at another time. But first, Apple, an update on the Apple FBI battle. Apple had been served a court order by the FBI compelling them to unlock a phone. Apple has now challenged that order with an official reply to the court, saying essentially, no, we're not going to do it. A quote from their brief says that no court has ever authorized what the government now seeks. No law supports such unlimited and sweeping use of the judicial process, and the Constitution forbids it. And it's also reported that Microsoft, Google, Twitter, Facebook, and Yahoo are planning to file briefs in support of Apple. So this fight is going to carry on.
One of the interesting things, of course, is that it's not just about one iPhone anymore.
Right.
True.
Yeah.
Right?
I know. Yeah.
There's this week it turns out that there's a very long queue of law enforcement agencies who can't wait, at least 12, and some articles say 16, some of them say hundreds, but apparently law enforcement agents are watching this very carefully, because as soon as this there'll be a queue outside of Apple's door of policemen.
Right.
You can almost see it. It's like something out of a movie, you know, like sitting there with boxes of phones, like, you've got to fix these. And although a majority of people in the US are in favor of Apple giving up doing what the FBI asks, it's not a huge majority. It's like 56% to 40% or something like that.
Right.
So it's not like 80-20 Apple's doing. In fact, the majority that's actually in favor of the FBI is actually very, very thin. And the government must be really peeved right about now that they're not winning the PR battle.
Mm-hmm. Well, they, you know, shot themselves in the foot with unwarranted surveillance. So,
well, I'm really looking forward to when the FBI loses an iPhone in China and the Chinese government says, we want a back door to crack this FBI phone open, because that's legal, right?
Right. All right. Let's leave that there, and we'll definitely be coming back to this as it progresses. But some news from the vendor side: Martin Casado, who was the founder of the Nicira startup and then went on to lead VMware's network and security business unit, is leaving for Andreessen Horowitz. He's going to become a venture capital guru.
So when it first broke, the suggestion was, and I sort of felt that this was a bit of a blow for VMware, and I'm sure it is, because it was just 2 weeks ago that they announced that NSX was the great growth of the company. They expect that it's going to be the big successful product going forward.
Yeah, it's going to be the successor to the hypervisor.
That's right. So as the ESX hypervisor reaches saturation point in its market, and people are really moving to KVM or, you know, one of the other hypervisors out there, moving away from the ESX system in the cloud, especially the public cloud, they need a new revenue stream to keep their growth online and justify their share price.
And that's NSX.
And then the person who invented and heads up that business unit suddenly heads off. That's not a good look, right?
Yeah, right, yeah.
The timing is not great.
Yeah.
But if you look at it from Martin's point of view, Andreessen Horowitz is like the biggest, and he's going to be a general partner over there. So he's going to be able to go and invest in startups to his heart's content. That's not a job offer that you get every day of the week or that you can put on hold for very long.
That's right.
Hell yeah, I would do. You know, you can't help but say, hell yes, go. Get out of there. Go and do that.
Godspeed,
because you could go
man.
And incubate another 5 or 10 of these companies that are going to transform networking. That's a really attractive offer, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm. Yeah, sure.
But it does highlight the fact that VMware and EMC are suffering an exodus of executives. We've talked about this fairly consistently over the last 3 months, is that those companies, they're losing a lot of people, especially in the executive layer. And then down on the ground, there's a lot of people exiting those companies as well. Not necessarily in the NSX BU, don't get me wrong. Those companies don't appear to be at all happy. Now, whether that's because the companies themselves are unhappy places as they shrink and the revenue slows down, or because they're moving to Dell, who knows? Because the Dell takeover still isn't certain and it's looking shaky still.
And what I thought was interesting is that Martin's replacement is coming from outside the company. It's a guy named Dr. Rajiv Ramaswamy, who was previously at Brocade and before that at Cisco. So they decided to hire from outside VMware.
Not Brocade, Broadcom.
Broadcom.
He's been at Broadcom for a long time, building silicon and switching there. And then previously he did a stint at Cisco. Seems like just about everybody in networking's done a stint at Cisco. Mm-hmm. Which can be a good thing or a bad thing. Sometimes it's a bad thing for companies because they bring all of their Cisco bad habits with them. But, on the other hand, they have experience of the industry. It's an outsider, but he's been in the company for some time, I believe. But he does have deep expertise in networking. Apparently, he's been heavily involved in the business for a while.
A lot of people I know at BCE are quite nervous right now, so that because of everything that's going on there. And on the Cisco, everybody being at Cisco, you know, when I was at Cisco, we always used to joke that that Cisco has done a very good job of staffing every startup in the Valley.
There's probably some truth to that.
Yeah. One of the things I find edifying is all of them go back. I'm not sure what that says about the quality of people at Cisco or whether that they do very well at startups or
I don't know.
I didn't. Okay. Well, this seems like a good point to talk about our second sponsor of the week, which is Aruba Atmosphere. In 2 weeks, Ethan and I will be down in Las Vegas at the Aruba Atmosphere Conference. It's the largest mobility conference on Earth. It takes place March 6th through the 11th at the Cosmopolitan of Las Vegas. And we're going to have some keynote speakers, including HPE's CEO, Meg Whitman, breakout session and technology demos. Ethan and I will be there to record several podcasts with Aruba. We're going to be talking about Wi-Fi, beacons, and also the future of the HPE Aruba integration. What's that look like? Now, I recorded a show which sort of gave you some insights to that in December and published that. We're talking to Oza. But we're going to reprise that again with the CEO of the Aruba HPE networking team and really tell you what that's going to look like going forward. So during the conference, keep an eye on the Packer Pushers Twitter account. Follow us on various social media where we'll be spamming you to let you know what we are and when. And if you're there, do come and meet up with us. So we're going to be hanging around the social media area as part of the social media crew there. And we'd love to hear from you. If you want to come over and say hi, we'd love to speak to you.
All right, yeah, keep an eye out for Greg and Ethan wandering the halls of Aruba Atmosphere. And Greg, this is a story that you pulled into the feed. EMC launches EMC Provider Cloud System.
Yeah, isn't this so EMC actually is attempting to get into service providers as an NFV provider of all things.
What?
Yeah. So, and so you go over and you read it and you think EMC, service provider, NFV, cloud, like we're going to build NFV clouds for service providers. And you're sort of going like, and then I went, oh, I know. EMC had an initiative. It's probably been in the pipeline for 3 or 4 years. They thought they could get into the, into service providers by offering cloud build-out strategies. And then, of course, the merger with Dell makes this pointless, but the merger with Dell hasn't happened. But you've spent 3 years putting the product together, so what do? Do you kill it off or do you announce it? Because if the deal doesn't go through, do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, sure. They're just saying this might not, the whole Dell thing may not go through. So let's just roll with it and see what happens.
It's just one of those, like, when you're doing a buyout, there's things that, projects that just don't make sense anymore. But because the buyout hasn't been a done deal, they still keep, and you just look at them and go,
Well, I don't know. To me, whenever I talk at cloud partners and channel partners, one thing I try to impress on the guys that are building CSPs and MSPs is, you need to own your architecture and you need to own your own business. The reason you're in business is not because you buy Cisco, EMC, Juniper, blah, 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 and you just implement it better than the guy that's buying your cloud service can. It's because you're actually building a service. This kind of – I don't know that if I were a provider, I would be thinking about going to EMC and buying NFV services. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, but – I am a provider.
Well, keep in mind that EMC is now selling, is rebadging Qantas. And of course, they've got, world class storage. And that, but in that market, they're going to be competing against the Nokia Airframe, which is a much more established player in that NFV, CPE environment. Ericsson's got a platform. They've got a deal where they've partnered up with Fujitsu and now also with Cisco. So they can offer an NFV platform in the mobile carrier space, which is going to be much more compelling than that. Of course, Dell wants to be in that space, but HPE particularly has an enormous footprint. They're the leading NFV contender today and have signed several contracts with Telefonica and Swisscom to provide NFV platforming in there. For EMC to sort of come out with we're going to do some NFV is a bit sort of,
I don't see EMC at the table at domain.2.0 discussions or road discussions with AT&T. That's what's kind of strange about it.
Yes, that's fundamentally it. But again, I think, you're half pregnant, right? So do you kill the NFV and you wait to get to Dell? But if it doesn't come off, you need to have the momentum,
Yeah.
What do you do?
Yeah, it's very.
And so they've decided to come out with a half-hearted.
So are they actually going after? Do you think they're actually going? Well, it is Mobile World Congress, so they are going after like Telefonica and stuff like that. So that does make sense.
Because my guess would be is that EMC sees itself as the enterprise arm of HPE.
Yeah.
So they are going to post the enterprise arm of Dell. So Dell's got a very solid, small, middle-sized and enterprise arm, but it's never really penetrated in as an enterprise service provider to the high end of the stack. So EMC is going to take that over, and they're going to bring their enterprise sales skills in. And the next step from there is, of course, the service providers, because they're some of the biggest customers in the world.
Yeah.
So I imagine that this is an attempt for EMC to say, we're going to do NFV when we get to Dell, or that's the dream anyway.
Well, this is something we'll also be keeping an eye on, see how that plays out. And last but not least, Greg, you are going to give us your sprint through the most recent financial news from some big names.
Yeah, so there's not much finance news this week, so you know, rest easy. This isn't going to be long. Mellanox completes the EasyChip acquisition. So, of course, Mellanox has a silicon manufacturing arm and a silicon photonics manufacturing capability. And now that it's acquired EasyChip, it's extending its reach, especially around network adapters and its own processor engines inside of its chip. So it'll be interesting to see how that goes. Infoblox announced its results a couple of days ago and got absolutely hammered again. Share price is down 10% after being coming up over the last – they had a really bad period in about 9 months ago. Share price fell by 50%. They boosted it up a fair bit, but then it got hammered because even though they've announced really good money, 30% increases in licenses and 20% more maintenance contracts, it's still less than what they predicted, and Wall Street likes nothing more than money. But more importantly, the next quarter they predicted significant drops. They think that there's a lot less money around next month. The people in Wall Street said it's time to go off and put my money somewhere else, in oil maybe or something. Palo Alto Networks is basking in the afterglow of the current enterprise IT trend to waste money on fancy firewalls and implement security blankets. A security blanket is where you throw a blanket over all of your IT and you pretend that it's safe. Right? Everything underneath, it's not very safe, but there you go.
You suck your thumb while you hold it.
Pretty much. Palo Alto Networks has had a great quarter. Product revenue's up 47% to $170 million in the quarter, but services revenue is up a stonking 61% to $160 million. So that's actually saying that they're now selling more services revenue than they are hardware product revenue. So no, sales of firewall doesn't mean any. Is now becoming less than services revenue. So all of you who are subscribing to Palo Alto's firewall subscriptions and DDoS services and threat and malware license subscriptions, Palo Alto Networks loves you. So showing that you people love nothing better than wasting your OPEX on cloud services. God bless you all.
Well, that brings us to the end of this edition of Network Break. Thanks to our sponsors, Riverbed, the application performance company. And please check out our latest weekly show podcast with Riverbed talking about Wireshark, among other things. Also, thanks to Aruba Atmosphere, the mobility conference, which is in Las Vegas, March 6th through 11th. And Greg and Ethan will be there wandering around recording podcasts. In the meantime, Greg, where can folks get more from you if they want to hear from you?
They can find me on my blog at etheriumon.com and on the Twitter is at etheriumon.
And Russ, thank you always for joining us. And where can folks hear more from you?
Twitter, Routing Geek, and my blog is network.guru.
All right. And I'm Drew Conry Murray. I blog at packerpushers.net. You can find me on Twitter at Drew_CM. Thank you so much for joining us for another episode of Network Break. If you like the show, please give us a like on Facebook or leave a recommendation on iTunes or share a show with your friends. Please check out our newsletters, Human Infrastructure Magazine and Link Propagation. We'll have links to those at packerpushers.net. Thanks for listening.